So, the classical theory of capitalism's future, the history of the future. So just to re-ground us on the agenda, it's pretty clear, I think, if you are a sharp critic of capitalist institutions and you believe another world is possible, but you see enormous obstacles in the world as it exists to getting from here to there. It's pretty clear that if you had some credible theory of what the future held in store due to the unfolding of causal processes that, in a sense, operate behind the backs of people, what are called laws of motion of a society, if you had some idea of what of how the contradictions and obstacles you face now, what it would look like 20 years from now, 50 years from now, if you had some time horizon understanding where things were heading, it would help you to think more rigorously about the strategies to engage in now. The strategies for the transformation of capitalism have to be long-term. It can't be short-term. Nobody imagines that if we were just really clever with some strategic idea, we could transform the world in the next 6 weeks, right? So we know it has to be long-term. You have to engage in activities now whose payoffs will be in the future. Well, if you had some way of predicting other things about the future, it would really help you develop those strategies. That's, I think, the central purpose for all of this stuff about the dynamics of the system and the trajectories of history, whether it be of the general theory or the specific theory of capitalist history. The whole reason for doing this was to help inform the activities of people who took seriously the 11th thesis of Feuerbach, you know, Marx's early statement, philosophers have only interpreted the world, the point is to change it. Well, the point is to change it, knowing what you confront down the road matters a lot. Now, one view could be, we really don't know what the world in the future is going to hold. All we know is there will be moments when the system is chaotic. We don't know when. We don't have a view that it gets worse and worse. We just know that there's going to be periodic episodes of crisis. And all we need to do is to think strategically now, how can we be in a position to seize the time when that happens? That's a much weaker view than Marx's. But it still would be an account, not so much of the future, but of the rhythms of the society. So if capitalism is the kind of social system which periodically has deep crises, we don't know when, and we don't have any reason to believe they get worse, just that they happen. And you believe that crisis is the occasion in which transformations become possible, you could have a view. What we have to do is to organize now and maintain that organization over time so that when those crises occur, we can seize the time. That's a kind of fallback position, second strategy, way of thinking about the time horizons of action. But Marx wanted to do something stronger than that. He wanted to give activists today confidence that if they make certain kinds of choices now, this will enhance the capacity for the kind of revolutionary transformation that's needed in order to transcend capitalism. As we saw in the last lecture and the lectures before, one attempt at doing this was the grand general theory of history, which has gotten a lot of attention. It's the main object of Jerry Cohen's book. I don't think it's very successful. Well, it has lots of successful components. I don't think it's not successful as a general theory of history. But in the end, really, it may not matter how successful the general theory of history, so long as we have a good specific history of capitalists, specific theory of capitalism's history. That would really be enough. It could be the case that the development of capitalism out of feudalism occurred for Weberian reasons. Was the Protestant ethic and the spirit of capitalism that explains how capitalism emerged? Well, so be it. That may not in any way undermine the account of the future of capitalism. Once capitalism is created and set in motion, then it does have, the argument would go, laws of motion which predictably push it in a particular way, which we can theorize with sufficient precision that it can inform our sense of what we have to do, what the tasks of transformation are. So that's what I'd like to turn to now, the overall structure of the theory of the historical trajectory of capitalism. This little diagram maps out what I think are the key elements of the theory. There's, of course, a lot more to Marxist theory of capitalism than just this. There's, for example, the superstructure doesn't figure in here. I haven't added that to this picture. There's much more that you would add to really fully represent diagrammatically the Marxian perspective. The point of this diagram is just to show what the causal streams are that give us a predictable future to capitalism. That's the key issue to be thought through here. And let me first just tell you how to read this picture, and then we'll decompose it into a series of more specific claims. The core idea then is we can diagnose the internal contradictions inside of capitalism which animate its dynamics, which set it on a particular path. And the key idea there is contradiction, that this is a kind of system which generates conflicts that make simple reproduction of the system impossible. The conflicts have the character of continually pushing the system in new ways. This generates two streams of causes. I've separated them here. Of course, these things are interconnected. Again, this is to strip it down to its bare minimum. The top stream helps to explain over time why capitalism becomes more and more vulnerable to challenge rather than stronger and stronger. So the laws of motion of a system could simply develop the system in particular ways and have no particular implications for how robust or weak the system would be. Or the development logic of a system could make it stronger and stronger. Or, and that's the Marxian claim, there's something about the development of capitalism, its internal dynamics, which push it in ways that make it more and more unstable and vulnerable. That's the top stream. That's the stream that's bound up with the general theory's idea of fettering, but it's the particular capitalist form of fettering. The bottom stream of causes says not only is capitalism becoming more and more vulnerable, but capitalism also generates social actors, collective agents capable of challenging it, and they get stronger and stronger. So you have two causal streams. One says the structure gets more fragile, and the other says the challengers become stronger. Well, that's a pretty explosive combination. The claim from the combination of these two causal streams is not that the challengers are only capable of producing a new society once the structure collapses of its own contradictions. So it's not a view that capitalism first destroys itself and then the challengers take over. No, it's that there's these two things going on. It's becoming weaker and weaker. The challengers become stronger and stronger. And at some point, the challengers are strong enough to overthrow the system because it's been weakened. But that could be way before the system would actually have collapsed on its own. There's a quip that Marx makes at one point that Jerry Cohen quotes in this context, which is, history is the judge, the proletariat is the executioner. The history is the judge part is saying this, it's the unfolding of the laws of motion of capitalism that makes capitalism weak and condemned, but it still takes workers to organize to overthrow it. And they need not wait until it collapses. They know that it will eventually collapse. That's the top stream says eventually capitalism just becomes completely unsustainable. But given that you know it's going to be completely unsustainable eventually, why not try to overthrow it as soon as it's weak enough to be overthrowable? It's the coincidence of these two causal streams that makes a socialist rupture both possible and ultimately a rupture with capitalism inevitable. Now, why in the aftermath of the rupture it's socialism that's produced as opposed to something else? That's the kind of outcome of rupture. On that, the theory is less systematic. The theory is very systematic about the demise of capitalism and the agents, the historical agents capable of overthrowing it, of bringing that demise about. It's much less systematic about the alternative. And I like to say, again, this is a little bit of a sloganish way of saying it, I like to say that Marx's actual theory of socialism is more or less where there's a will, there's a way. It's pretty much a voluntaristic theory. What you have are a set of collective actors who have interests in building a democratic egalitarian alternative. Workers would actually benefit from such a system. They have the power to build new institutions because they've just overthrown old institutions. That means they're powerful and collectively organized. And then with those two ingredients, the will and the capacity, well, they'll find the way to do it. The basic view of how workers collectively organized in powerful ways would actually build socialism is essentially, I think, what could be called democratic experimentalism. It's trial and error, collective action, building new institutions in a context where it would be a good thing to do, and they recognize it, and they have a capacity to do so. That still falls short of demonstrating that they're actually capable of accomplishing that task. And Marx was, and for good reason, was extremely vague about that issue. Yeah?
Just a little question. Do you agree with the claim that the demise of capitalism is inevitable?
I don't think there's good argument for that. I think it's not that I believe the opposite, that capitalism inherently has a capacity for indefinite reproduction. But I don't think that the arguments for why its internal contradictions are of the sort that don't just lead it to transform itself into new forms of capitalism, but lead it to actually be incapable of reproducing itself. I don't think those arguments are well-grounded. Yeah?
So this, I mean, you can not answer it, but like, just keep up. So your democratic experimentalism that you think Marx is talking about, presumably, like, the socialist revolutions that we have experienced didn't think, like, what's their position on what Marx is arguing this, because they clearly don't believe that.
Well, they claimed they did. They always called the institutional practices of the new regimes democratic. They all adopt, or many of them adopted that word. The, you know, East Germany was the democratic, the GDR, the German Democratic Republic. So they all claimed democracy. They all claimed that they were a deeper form of democracy than bourgeois democracy. The theory of the vanguard party.
But the experimentalism, right? I mean, that part, do you think they would accept that too and just be able to disagree on how that would look? Or?
I think the ideological thrust of the defense of central planning was less democratic experimentalism than democratic centralism. That is, it was a view that the party knew what it was doing. Its intellectuals had solved these problems and could design from above in a way that was allegedly but not really accountable to the people, the new institutional designs. So I don't think the experimentalist idea actually had a lot of traction.
I mean, just for my, to help, like, for me to, like, put these people in boxes. So would saying, like, democratic centralism versus democratic experimentalism is, like, the different, like, that's
it's with the vanguard. I think the key is the idea of a vanguard party. The vanguard party, that's the idea that there's a group of class-conscious, politically conscious, advanced thinkers who control a political apparatus, and they know what's best. And then they are supposed to be accountable to the people. That's part of the rhetoric, but they're not. I mean, a vanguard party is not meant to be an authoritarian police state. That's, nobody defended that. Nobody said, what we're doing is an elitist, top-down, authoritarian, repressive thing, unaccountable to the people. No. But the idea of the vanguard is that the vanguard knows what's best. And knows what's best, not just in the sense of we know what's in the interests of people, but we know how to realize those interests. And that's a kind of anti-experimentalist view, I think. Okay, that's the overall structure. Now let's break it down into its constitutive elements. Okay, so the first thesis is the long-term non-sustainability of capitalism thesis. And it reads as a formal thesis, in the long run, capitalism is an unsustainable economic system. Its internal dynamics, and the language that Marxists have used to describe that idea is laws of motion, systematically undermine the conditions of its own reproducibility, thus making capitalism progressively more and more fragile, and eventually unsustainable. The meaning of the idea that capitalism is contradictory is fundamentally that its dynamics undermine its own conditions of existence, rather than that its dynamics continually strengthen its conditions of existence. The dynamics of capitalism undermine its conditions of existence. This prediction was based, I think, on four empirical observations that Marx made and were continually validated, I think, in the course of the 19th century. Four empirical observations, and then a fantastically interesting, but ultimately unsatisfactory, I think, theoretical argument about what the mechanisms were that generated these trends. So this is really a classic piece of very good theoretical thinking. Even if it's, in the end, unsatisfactory, it's really the right way to go about theorizing. It's not unlike the way climate change theorists work. So how do we make projections? So our current most important theory of the history of the future that we're all contending with centers on climate change. And you've all seen the projections, right? Those projections into the future are not simple linear extrapolations of the past. A lot of futurology is just that. You look at trends and you just continue the trend lines. No, what you see when you see these predictions are bands. You see, you know, maximums and minimums and probabilities of where you're going to fall within these bands, right? That's the way these graphs about future climate change. What you have then is an historical record of climate change over the last 100 years, and the strategy of people making the predictions of the future, basically the strategy is this. What they ask the question, what must the underlying mechanisms be that produce the change from 1900 to 2014, let's say? And once you establish those mechanisms, you then gather data relevant to those mechanisms and see if you can reproduce the actual historical trajectory from 1900 to 2014. So a good model of the future would also say, now let's pretend we're in 1900. Can we predict 2014 from 1900? Right? Can we predict what's already happened? And if the model very closely tracks what's already happened, that adds credibility that the model will also predict into the future. And that's essentially what they try to do. The more things the model predicts successfully between 1900 and 2014, if it doesn't just predict air temperatures, but it also predicts seawater acidity, and it also predicts ice melting. You know, if it predicts, the more different parameters it can predict, the more confident you are that the underlying theory of the mechanisms and their interactions is probably a pretty good approximation. It becomes less and less likely that completely wrong-headed accounts of the underlying causal processes, that those underlying causal processes are wrong-headed if they are able to predict more and more things that happened that we know happened. And then you can apply this through computer simulations and then making estimates of different kinds of parameters to give you an account of the future. Well, that's what climate science is doing. That's essentially what Marx did for capitalism. The equivalent of his average temperature is the rate of profit. What Marx argued, and I think for good reason, the key parameter that is important for the health of capitalism is the rate of profit. If the rate of profit is zero, stable, zero, capitalism becomes extremely unstable. Capitalism, in order to be a stable system and to generate the surplus needed for its own reproduction, which means funding the superstructures as well as funding accumulation, it needs to generate a positive rate of profit. So if we can predict the rate of profit, we can say something about the future of capitalism. So you begin then, in a sense, with some empirical observations about the past. So here there are four empirical observations which I think underlie this model. First, in the course of capitalist development, the level of productivity increases enormously, particularly because of the productivity gains from the increasing capital intensity of production. So writing in the middle of, or the second, third, in the third quarter of the 19th century, one of the striking things that an observer of capitalism would say is, compared to 100 years ago, we are fantastically more productive. And this increase in productivity comes largely from the substitution of machines for tools. That is, 100 years ago, things were made by hand, with hand tools. Now they're made by big machines driven by power, steam. The transformation of productivity by increasing the capital intensity of production was one of the empirical observations. So that's the first empirical observation. A second empirical observation: capitalism expands relentlessly in a double sense. More and more domains of production are commodified and organized by capitalist firms. So more and more areas of life become provided by the market, organized by capitalist firms. And capitalist markets extend over ever wider reaches of the world. Marx was a fantastic early theorist of globalization. He felt that the dynamics of capitalism empirically have led to the marketization of everything and the market expansion of markets everywhere. So there's both a deepening of markets and an expansion of markets. And that's a trend which, of course, continues to the present day. There are more people buy more of the things of life today than they did 100 years ago. And they buy more of the things of life in the market than they did when I was a kid. And more of the world, of course, is subsumed under market relations now. More people's lives are bound up with their ability to sell things on the market than was the case even a few decades ago. That's the third empirical trend. The third empirical trend. Capitalist development tends to increase the concentration and centralization of capital. Over time, capitalist firms become larger and larger. That's what Marx called the centralization of the concentration of capital. It gets bigger and bigger. And the percentage of production controlled by those large firms steadily increases. That's what Marx called the centralization of capital. But it's basically the absolute size of units of capital gets bigger and they dominate the market. There's fewer, they control a bigger share of the market. This means that not only does the world become ever more organized through capitalist markets, but those markets become ever more dominated by giant firms. That was the third observation for the 19th century at the time Marx was formulating these ideas. And then the fourth observation, which was pretty astute in the 19th century, and which is perhaps less clear as an observation today, although some people would still argue it, is that capitalism not only generates periodic economic crises, that's certainly true, capitalism is a crisis-prone economic system, but those crises tend to become more serious and prolonged as capitalism develops. So when Marx looked back over the 19th century and compared the kind of economic crisis, unemployment, crises that occurred at the beginning of the century to the way they were looking in the middle of the century, his conclusion was when crises occur, they're worse. And that observation pretty much continued until the people pretty much felt that had a lot of credibility. Through the immediate post-World War II period. The 1930s collapse was certainly worse than anything that had come before, and the 1896 collapse, or 95-96 crisis, was worse than anything that had happened before that, and the 1871, 2-3, whatever, I don't remember the exact, was worse than anything that had happened before that. So there was a sense that crises not only occur, but they occur with greater intensity. So then the question is, let's assume, and I think with good reason, that these are all trends that we've observed from the beginning of capitalism through the time Marx is formulating his model. So then Marx asks the question, what must be true about the underlying laws of motion that generate these trends? These are the observations. What's the mechanism? What's making this happen? I think the pivotal idea here is Marx's understanding of the underlying mechanisms which generate the rate of profit in the economy and how those mechanisms lead to what he calls the falling tendency of the rate of profit. The law of the falling tendency of the rate of profit. And he used the word law, and that's not an innocent word, and certainly not in 19th century writing. To describe it as a law means that it's an inbuilt, inherent process built into the very dynamics of the system. That's the analysis of the processes that generate the aggregate rate of profit is what ties together all of these trends and then makes it possible to make a prediction about the future. So there are two components of this idea of the law of the falling tendency of the rate of profit. First, there are periodic rises and falls in the rate of profit which generate what we know as the business cycle. So the first point is a simple one. The rate of profit isn't just a constant. It goes up and down. There's some kind of business cycle. And there are many factors which contribute to this. Marx subsumes these all under the expression the anarchy of the market. The anarchy of the market creates all sorts of disruptions. And these many different kinds of disruptions don't have any particular cumulative character. They're just different ways that things can go badly. There's a tendency for what Marx called overproduction. Capitalist firms tend to produce more than the market can absorb. There's also a tendency for capitalists to push the wages of their workers down because they will make more profits if they can save on costs. But this leads to what could be called underconsumption. There aren't enough buyers. These two things are connected. You produce too much for the market, and then you push wages down so there's not enough buyers for the things that you produce. These particular processes which Marx identified are very closely connected to the kinds of crisis mechanisms that John Maynard Keynes identified in the 20th century. Those are just the business cycle mechanisms. Those are partially what determines variability over time in the rate of profit. But that doesn't generate any long-term trend, just instability, ups and downs. Marx also, however, postulated a mechanism which gradually reduces the average rate of profit in a capitalist economy across business cycles. So this isn't just a theory about fluctuation. It's about why the conditions for the generation of profits themselves deteriorate. Now, this part of the theory has a lot of technical stuff. It's bound up with the particular way Marx formulated the labor theory of value. And I don't want to get into any of the technical aspects of this argument. The core idea, though, is this, that profits are generated exclusively out of the exploitation of labor. Right? So that's where the surplus comes from, is the exploitation of labor. And the value of the surplus is the value of the labor so exploited. The rate of profit is the ratio of the value of the surplus divided by all the costs of production. Not just the value of labor power, but all the costs of production, including the costs of capital. So in the labor theory of value formulation, the rate of profit is S over C plus V. That's the rate of profit. So the costs of production include both the cost of capital and the cost of labor, but the profits come entirely from the labor component. So the basic intuition here is that if capital intensity goes up, if you need more and more capital for every worker in order to be competitive, because that's the source of productivity, if the costs on the denominator keep going up because you use more and more capital, but exploitation comes entirely from the labor component of your costs of production, the denominator is going to rise more rapidly than the numerator. You can try to compensate for this by pushing up the rate of exploitation, by having more surplus pumped out of the workers, but there's a limit to that. Whereas the costs of capital keep going up because capital intensity keeps going up. Marx referred to that capital intensity problem as with a not exactly intuitive term. He calls it the organic composition of capital. It's basically, if you look at the total composition of capital, capital consists of labor costs and capital costs. The organic composition is the density of the capital costs relative to the living, you know, the human costs. That's why he called it the organic composition of capital. This organic composition of capital tends to rise because of competition. So competition between capitalists forces them to innovate. They innovate by substituting capital for labor. Each individual capitalist has an advantage by substituting capital for labor. That raises their ability to compete with other capitalists. And until other capitalists follow suit and also raise their capital intensity, for that period, the rate of profit for that particular capitalist will be higher than others because they'll be able to charge prices higher in the market. So this is why this gets technical. But competition is going to wipe those out eventually. And the new rate of profit will be lower because there's more capital costs. Marx then sees this as inherent in capitalism, and that in the long run, it therefore lowers the aggregate rate of profit, which then means that whenever there's a business cycle, more and more firms will have negative profits. You know, there's less of a margin. If you have a high aggregate rate of profit, then a business cycle just means profits dip below that high average, but they can still be positive. If you have a very low, razor-thin rate of profit in the aggregate, then when the business cycle causes disruption, lots of firms have negative profits. And the system becomes increasingly unstable as a result. Okay, that's the first thesis. Let me run through the rest of these more quickly, and then we'll discuss problems with these theses. So for the moment, let's just assume this first thesis is correct, that there is a long-run tendency for the rate of profit to decline. And while countermeasures can slow that decline at particular moments, and after crises, the rate of profit will tend to rise from the worst moments of the crisis, this long-term secular trend cannot be blocked in the long run. And therefore, capitalism becomes, in the long term, unsustainable. Second thesis. This switches down to the bottom causal structure. The intensification of anti-capitalist class struggle thesis. The development of capitalist, the dynamics of capitalist development systematically tend, first, to increase the proportion of the population, the working class, whose interests are hurt by capitalism, and at the same time, to increase the collective capacity of the working class to challenge capitalism. The result is an intensification of class struggle directed against capitalism. So capitalism does all sorts of things. It destroys small producers. It destroys agrarian smallholders. It brings masses of people into the cities. The key observation here is that what capitalism does is bring more and more people under its own economic organization. And so the proportion of the population that is working class increases. This is referred to as proletarianization. Proletarianization of labor is one of the long-term trends of capitalism. A higher proportion of the population, of the working age population, are working for capitalist firms. In the 19th century, this was most notably marked by a decline of self-employed small farmers, peasants in some places, small farmers in others. And at the same time that it destroys all these non-capitalist forms of employment, it increases the capacities of workers to challenge capitalism. So it'd be one thing to destroy pre-capitalist relations and smallholders to create more workers, but it doesn't necessarily mean that those workers have a greater capacity for struggle. Well, Marx's account of the development of capitalism argued not only is there proletarianization, but there's also a process by which the proletarians so created have increasing class capacity for resistance and struggle. But that also develops in the course of capitalism. We've discussed some of that back in the early weeks of the semester when we talked about theories of class formation and the basic way in which that develops and how Marx thought about it. The important point in this part of the thesis, just to remember, this is a standard sociological point now, not just a point that comes from the Marxist tradition, Grievances are never sufficient to explain conflicts. It's never enough to say capitalism hurts workers to explain why workers resist. They also have to have a capacity to resist. There's always enough grievances in the world for people to engage in conflict, but they don't always engage in collective conflict because they don't always have the capacity to do so. Well, what Marx felt was that capitalism actually digs its, you know, creates the grave diggers of capitalism because it doesn't just create workers, but it brings them together in very large workplaces. And it homogenizes their conditions of existence. So along with simply proletarianization, there's also homogenization of the working class. And there's the creation of physical spaces, of huge agglomerations of relatively homogeneous workers, all interacting with each other within the labor process, within the division of labor, which therefore increases the ease of communication and coordination among workers needed for collective action. In one of Marx's writings on these issues, he contrasts the increasing capacity of workers for collective action with the condition of peasants, who he refers to as a sack of potatoes. That is, peasants are just discrete, separate persons that don't form a collective actor in his vision of, I guess this was with respect to 19th century France, and that's because they all live on small holdings and are scraping a living on their own. They're not engaged in an interdependent division of labor where they mutually communicate with each other and depend upon each other in the way that workers in large factories were. So that leads to the second thesis, the intensification of anti-capitalist class struggle. So we're getting pretty far on this theory. Capitalism is becoming more and more unsustainable, weaker and weaker, and workers are getting stronger and stronger, and there's getting to be more and more of them, and they're being brought into bigger and bigger agglomerations. This culminates then in what can be called the revolutionary transformation thesis. Since capitalism becomes increasingly precarious as an economic system, that's thesis one, while the principal class arrayed against capitalism becomes increasingly large and capable of challenging capitalism, thesis two, since those two theses hold, eventually the social forces opposing capitalism will be strong enough and capitalism weak enough that the institutions designed to protect capitalism will no longer be able to prevent it from being overthrown. Now that's the key element here. The institutions designed to protect capitalism can no longer do so. Capitalism becomes so weak that even with a state dedicated to preserving capitalism, and even with bourgeois media and ideological production designed to confuse people, even with all that stuff, capitalism is just so enfeebled and the working class is so strong that those mechanisms of superstructural reproduction can no longer do the job. And that's when that happens, then, of course, the context for a revolutionary transformation takes place. The superstructure becomes weak for a variety of reasons. The simplest is that as the rate of profit declines, it becomes harder and harder to adequately fund the state. So one component of a superstructural crisis is the fiscal crisis of the state. The state just becomes weakened. Its capacity to reproduce the system is weakened because to the extent that it's funded, it's reducing the effective rate of profit for capital even more because the state is a kind of overhead cost of capitalism. So the state is weakened in part just because the fiscal constraints, but also because of this endless deepening of economic crises, the fact that crises become more intense when they occur, the business cycle crises become worse and worse because the rate of profit is declining, capitalism is failing to deliver the goods, and thus its ideological justifications become thinner and thinner, more and more vulnerable to being criticized. So it's a combination of the weakening of the state's capacity for repression by virtue of it being starved of funds and the declining credibility of the system, which means that the ideological superstructures become more and more vulnerable to demystification. These two things are what really bring about the possibility for revolutionary transformation. Now, Marx was pretty vague about the actual process by which such a transformation would actually occur. Typically, Marxists have envisioned this transformation as very ruptural, as involving a violent revolution which smashes the state. And the reason why the state has to be smashed is because the state is reproducing now this enfeebled class structure, and you've got to get rid of that in order to animate an alternative economic structure. But actually, Marx doesn't commit himself to violent overthrow. Subsequent Marxists mostly did in the late 19th century. They mostly felt that overthrow would take that form. But there were always plenty of Marxists who felt that the actual transformation could occur through democratic institutions, that the bourgeois state itself was contradictory. Marx certainly made that argument. And that the democratic apparatuses of the state created at least the possibility of a democratic transition out of capitalism. That the democratic state could be seized through democratic means, and it could just simply be used and itself transformed. Well, we discussed the ambiguities of that formulation, and in any case, the key idea is that through one way or another, a revolutionary crisis would occur where the capacity to transform is sufficiently strong to overcome both the political and ideological obstacles and to transform the underlying base, the underlying economic structure, because it has become so weak that it's transformable. That's the third thesis. The fourth thesis is the transition to socialism thesis. This is what happens after power is seized. Given the ultimate non-sustainability of capitalism and the interest and capacity of actors arrayed against capitalism, that's the first two theses, in the aftermath of the destruction of capitalism through class struggle, that's the third thesis, in that aftermath, socialism, defined as a society in which the system of production is collectively owned and controlled through egalitarian democratic institutions, is its most likely successor, since the collectively organizing working class will be in the best position to ensure that its interests are embodied in the new post-capitalist institutions. As I said, strictly speaking, the first three theses only provide the basis for the prediction that capitalism will come to an end, but don't provide any particular grounds for the belief that the alternative will be one that's desirable for workers. Now, one might say, well, why would workers bother overthrowing capitalism unless the alternative was going to be desirable? Well, they could hope it would be desirable. They could have the fantasy that it would be desirable without it actually being desirable. After all, peasants and workers and poor people were involved in the overthrow of absolutist monarchies at the end of the feudal era, in the hope that the new world would be a better one for them, and their hopes were dashed on the subsequent historical institution building of the elites of their time. So it doesn't logically follow, but nevertheless, Marx, I think, was optimistic, and subsequently, yeah.
Oh, I just want to make sure that I understand. So, egalitarian democratic society, not possible then just because they didn't have, the resources to support it, or, do you know what I mean?
So the one question is, why did it actually fail? But the other is, in Marx's theory, why did he expect it to succeed? So I first wanted to clarify the expectation. So Marx's expectation about its success was that these revolutionary transformations would occur in those parts of capitalism which were the most developed, where productivity was at its highest, because those would be the ones where the rate of profit had declined the most and where the working class had the greatest capacity for struggle. So part of this theory about the underlying endogenous mechanisms that generate these two trajectories in this figure also is a prediction as to where capitalist, anti-capitalist revolutions are going to occur. They're going to occur in the most favorable zones of the world, not the least favorable. Also, Marx believed that capitalism at the point where it was becoming moribund will have already created lots of the preconditions for socialism. Large industrial complexes with masses of workers brought together rather than small dispersed production that would be difficult to coordinate. He even sometimes said that the large mega corporation was already kind of social property since they're run by representatives of owners, not by the owners themselves. So think about the joint stock corporation. The joint stock corporation isn't actually run by the owners. The owners own shares. The actual firm is run by hired hands, very well paid, the managers, but they are nevertheless just hired. Well, Marx felt, so if you expropriated the owners, you just took over all the shares and called it social property, you could still hire the managers. You would want to do some changes in the internal organization, but it seemed like the corporation was already a more social form of production, less private in the strict sense. And it's part of our language for describing the corporation. When a corporation goes from a family firm owned by a particular group of people to a share-owned corporation, the IPO, the initial sale of shares, is called an initial public offering, and they are referred to as publicly traded firms. There is something slightly more public and social about the corporation. Well, Marx felt that was one of the reasons why socialism was going to be possible. You already have these giant corporations. They're already not actually run by their owners. It seemed like a smaller step than it would be if they were all small family firms. And finally, the key part of the optimism comes from the view that in order to overthrow capitalism, the working class would have to have become organized as a political force, which had a coherent perspective on how to organize things. It would be an ideologically advanced, class-conscious social force with political instruments in the form of parties with a vision. And so even if it still required a lot of additional steps to build the new institutions, all of this would set the stage for the building of an alternative. In the end, I think it still has a very strongly voluntaristic component to it. In the end, a lot of the action depends upon the creativity and will of actors to build new institutions in order to accomplish these goals. Finally, thesis 5. This is the utopian thesis within Marxism and is aspirational. This has even less argument in any classical texts than does the socialist transformation thesis. One can call it the communism destination thesis, which says that the dynamics of a socialist economy gradually leads to the strengthening of community solidarity and a progressive erosion of material inequalities so that eventually classes and the state will wither away, resulting in the emergence of a communist society organized around the principle to each according to need, from each according to ability, or a classless society. That is enunciated in various texts by Marx and subsequent Marxists, but it's always gestural. It's aspirational. It's what I would call the utopian moment within the Marxian framework. Okay, that's the structure of the theory of capitalism's future. The most well-worked-out parts are theses 1, 2, and 3. Thesis 4 is more speculative, and thesis 5 is ideal. It's idealistic rather than even speculative. It's not really the same kind of prediction as the others are. I think what we should do is take our break, and then we can talk about the inadequacy of each of these components, or the problems with them. Okay?